Fairylands of the South Seas by James Norman Hall and Charles Nordhoff. Preface. The islands of the South Seas are places of an interest curiously limited. The ethnological problem presented by the native is interesting only to men of science. Commerce is negligible. There is little real agriculture and no industry at all. There remains the charm of living among people whose outlook upon life is basically different from our own, of living with a simplicity foreign to anything in one's experience, amid surroundings of a beauty unreal both in actuality and in retrospect. It is impossible to write of the islands as one would write of France or Mexico or Japan. The accepted viewpoint of the traveler is not applicable here. A simple attempt to impart information would prove singularly monotonous, and one is driven to essay a different task, to pry into the life of the mingling races, hoping to catch something of its significance and atmosphere. Making such an attempt, it is necessary at times to dig deeper than would be consistent with good taste if names were mentioned, and for this reason, in the case of certain small islands, the ancient Polynesian names have been used instead of those given on the chart. All of the islands described are to be found in the Panamutu Society and Hervey Groups, JNH, CBN, Tahiti, April 10, 1921. End of preface. Chapter 1 of Fairylands of the South Seas, A Leisurely Approach. I don't remember precisely when it was that Nordhoff and I first talked of this adventure. The idea had grown upon us, one might say, with the gradual splendor of a tropical sunrise. We were far removed from the tropics at the time. We were, in fact, in Paris, and had behind us the greatest adventure we shall ever know. On the Place de la Concorde, among the Champs-Élysées, stood rank on rank of German cannon, silent enough now, but still menacing, their muzzles tilted skyward at that ominous slant one comes to know so well. For a month we had seen them so. Children perched astride them on sunny afternoons, rolling pebbles down their smooth black throats. Veterans in soiled and faded horizon blue, with the joy of this new quiet world bright on their faces, opening breech blocks, examining mechanism with the skill of long use at such employment, with a kind of wondering hesitation in their movements, too, as though at any moment they expected those sinister monsters in the fantastic colors of Harlequin to spring into life again. Those were glorious days. Never again, I think, will there be such a happy time as that in Paris. The boulevards are crowded, the tables filled under every awning in front of the cafes, and yet there seemed to be a deep silence everywhere, a silence intensified by the faint rustling of autumn leaves and the tramping of innumerable feet. One heard the sound of voices, of laughter, of singing, the subdued, continuous rumble of traffic, but not a harsh cry, not a discordant note. All the world seemed to be making holiday at the passing of a solemn, happy festival. Well, we had kept it with the others, Nordhoff and I have the memory of it now, to be enjoyed over and over again as the years pass. But there was danger that we might outstay the freshness of that period. We were anxious to avoid that for the sake of our memories, if for nothing else. While we were not yet free to order our movements as we chose, we pretended that we were, and so one rainy evening in the December following the armistice, we decided to call that chapter of existence closed, and to go forward with the making of new plans, for we meant to have further adventure of one kind or another, adventure in the sense of unexpected incident rather than hazardous activity. That had been a settled thing between us for a long time. We had no craving for excitement, but turned to plans for uneventful wanderings,